Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Well, 2023 has been quite a year for sports in many different ways, good, bad and ugly, and quite fantastic at times for both Ross and I. Both of us had the opportunity to travel to some international events this year. I went to the World Athletics Championships in Budapest, and Ross was at the Rugby World Cup, which was very special, I think, for both of us. So in this episode, we're going to wrap up some of the news that's been happening on our various channels, particularly on our Patreon channel, and some of the other news and highlights throughout the year, and also pick our best choices for 2023 in terms of highlights, lowlights, controversies, all that sort of thing. So that's a chance for us to kind of wrap up 2023. But let's kick things off with the man that's sitting opposite me at the moment, and that's Professor Ross Tucker, who's got more scars than, I don't know what has a lot of scars, but a lot of scars, because just over a week ago, Ross, you came very badly a cropper during one of our gravel bike rides. In fact, we'd done the race the day before where you finished first vet and 10th overall, and then the next day went for a nice casual ride, and you found a bump in the road that caused you to went right over the handlebars. It was quite a nasty accident, and I was just behind you. But
I saved you guys.
You saved us, because you went over this thing before we did and took a really bad fall. I mean, there was a lot of blood lying on the side. If you saw our social media channels on our social media over that time, you would have seen some pools of blood, and it was quite dramatic. But how are you feeling? I mean, it's been a week, almost 2 weeks now since it happened.
Yeah, I've been better. I've had better weeks in my life than last week, especially the first 3 or 4 days, and that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday afterwards, I could literally not move. I couldn't get up by myself, unassisted, because I couldn't use my hands because they were both damaged. I think I've done ligaments in my left arm, so I can't type. Mm. My right thumb and hand were really sore, so I couldn't push myself up, and my ribs were sore, so I couldn't use my core. So I had to be lifted up like a bag of potatoes every time I had to stand up. And then I couldn't put weight on the left leg because it was so bruised, the knee and so on. So I was hopping back and forwards to the bathroom between the bed and the couch and having to like call for assistance every time I got up. It was unbelievable, like quite humbling.
So your girlfriend is basically like a nurse.
Yeah, and then I think, shit, what must it be like to fracture your pelvis or do something really bad where you need even assistance in the bathroom? Mm. You need like a permanent person. So then I think actually I was lucky and unlucky at the same time.
Yeah, but you didn't break anything, which was...
Yeah, that was... Yeah. So, the...
But 8 stitches in your arm. I mean, we were there trying to sort of wash it out with some Dettol and some disinfectant actually at the crash site.
And I was so scared of an infection, eh?
Yeah. Remember
2 weeks... In the 2 weeks before the crash, we'd had two conversations about people who had died as a consequence of, like, gravel infections or surgical infections. Mm. And here I was getting stitched up in the hospital, and I kept saying, "Are you sure it's clean? Are you sure it's clean?" I said, "No, it's absolutely clean, no problem." And I was thinking, "No, clean it more,
because the result really of that scared. Is you can get septicemia, which can be fatal if you're not
watching."
Yeah,
and we know people who've had fatal septicemia, and it's quite terrifying to think that sort of thing can happen. So, and then a concussion on top of that. So for the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I could neither type. With basically 8 fingers, I had two fingers on the right hand that could work. Mm. And I couldn't look at the screen anyway because I'd get nauseous within a few minutes of this. So that was a different experience. And that's why, incidentally, I haven't published anything on Patreon. So now you know why.
It's
and
been
I
quite apologize. Quiet.
Because I wanted to let the patrons know why I couldn't publish, but the reason I couldn't publish stopped me from letting them know why I couldn't publish. So I was stuck in 12 days or whatever it was of purgatory. So, it was an interesting experience, and I wouldn't recommend it. That also gave me new appreciation for Tour de France cyclists, though, who because even when all you've got is like road rash, it's so inhibiting. Mm. Because like your skin, because I got some fairly deep ones on the front left side and on both knees. And once that scar starts forming, it actually gets so tight that even movement through the range of motion of a pedal motion would be sore every time you push the pedal down. Sure. It's just superficial stuff, but it's just, it's like 24 hours, it's 7 out of 10 pain.
Mm. And you're riding them in a Tour de France stage. Where
I mean,
couldn't imagine. They literally get back on the bike the next day a lot of the time, after a big crash. Unreal,
like just, it's new appreciation. Remember when Roglic had his ribs strapped up and so on, and I don't even think I broke any. I just think I strained intercostals or dislocated, maybe. But I couldn't imagine breathing hard for 5 or 6 days after that. So, yeah, it gave me new appreciation for that level of toughness as well.
So we were just looking at, I mean, just as a point of interest, because it's part of what we do here on the podcast, but also part of your experience about the four stages of wound healing: hemostasis, inflammation, proliferation, and remodeling. I mean, I suppose they all make sense, but hemostasis is obviously when the blood rushes to the site of the injury, isn't it?
Yeah, and the clotting parts. You get constriction of the blood vessels and the platelets, and you have to create a barrier as soon as possible. It's actually miraculous to watch it go happen in you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's happened to everyone, right? Even if it's a little cut. Like, okay, it bleeds, it clots, it heals. And then 2 weeks later, or however long, depending on the severity, it's gone. No evidence at all.
It's
quite amazing to watch. But yeah, you get these. So I've now got these like fairly substantial, like the front of my leg looks like a mountain range.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Like a, like with all different levels of clotting happening, depending on the depth of the wound. And
is it now in that sort of tight phase where you feel like you're splitting it every time you walk?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like the contractor muscle or bend my knee, I feel like I'm going to then rip the clot open. So so that happens quite quickly. And then what was second? Inflammation.
Inflammation.
And that's the bit. They gave me some fairly powerful anti-inflammatories. It's always tricky to know whether you should or shouldn't encourage inflammation. You know, like injuries, you want to limit it, but it's part of healing, right? Because if you didn't have it, so I always thought of inflammation as let's equate the damage to an earthquake striking a city, damaging the buildings. Inflammation is the process of removing the debris and bringing new materials in. That's effectively what it was, like, or so that you could bring new materials in. So dump trucks have to get in, wrecking balls have to knock down these structures so that you can build new foundations, new buildings on top of them. The problem is that if inflammation goes unchecked, then the process actually causes more damage than it is trying to fix, you know. So there's always a delicate balance. That's why there's all that debate about should you take anti-inflammatories after injury and so on. That's even a muscle strain. Never mind something like this where you get
because you actually want the inflammation, because that's it's doing the job.
Exactly. It's a necessary part of healing. It's not fun though, because you get swelling, and swelling compresses nerves. Those nerves are already sensitized by the inflammatory chemicals like prostaglandins that are there. And so now you get pain caused by inflammation. So, okay, take the pain away, block the inflammation, but actually that might slow the healing down. So it's a bit of a dilemma.
It's interesting, because if you look at sometimes when you look at those Tour de France and pro cycling events where they do fall and they've got the, what they often happens the next day is they're kind of wrapped up in a very sort of porous bandage. When they were treating you, even though you had quite substantial wounds, they were saying, just leave it open. I mean, why do they have bandages for the cyclists? I mean, help with the healing process?
I think comfort and to prevent infection.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
You know, like, I guess the assumption in my case is that I'm going to rest up, relax, lie on the couch in the bed, which I did, and not going to do anything that predisposes me to another infection, whereas they're actually going to, if you're going to be back on the bike, then you've got to cover it up, because you might then increase the risk in another way. So that's part of it. So you're applying ointments and then covering it so that those ointments stay on there for the 5 hours of stage 13 or whatever it is. So there's that. Because I said to some people, should I cover it? And they said, no, just apply the antibacterial and then leave it. You know, you want it to dry out as quickly as possible. Whereas they've got different incentives.
And it talks about proliferation, which is kind of when the first granular tissue starts forming and all the nerves come back. I mean, I guess that's the phase you're talking about, where the healing process starts.
The rebuild.
Exactly. And then at the final stage, remodeling, which is kind of where the scar tissue comes in. You get the scars, the chick's dig.
Yeah, there's that. And I mean, sometimes no scarring, like you just get remodeling and it disappears because it's remodeled. It's literally new skin, no scars. Mm. I mean, I think this thing on my arm, my forearm, the stitches will leave a scar.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But
do you, I mean, do you know if you obviously heal slow when you're older, I'd imagine. And we know that, for instance, diabetics, for instance, heal slower. So there's more chance of infection for people with diabetes. So
I'm type 2, so I have to be wearing. Open wounds are a major risk, right?
Yeah.
For infection.
Mm. And yesterday, in fact, I took my daughter for her jabs, and they now give a tetanus jab, which they give her when she's now 6 years old, another one at 12 years, which essentially gives a tetanus coverage for the rest of her life. And tetanus is obviously something, and I think we were talking about this in the car a couple of weeks back.
I had a tetanus shot after this.
You can die of tetanus because you can't cure it, can you?
Yeah, I read a stat somewhere, like untreated tetanus, if you don't get treatment for an infection, I mean, once that thing takes hold, it's your number's up.
Yeah.
So that's why
you had a tetanus for this accident, didn't you?
And it was interesting that I remember the doc saying to me, like, particularly, he asked me, did you fall on tarmac or was it gravel? And I said, no, it was gravel. And he said, okay, yeah, we treat those more seriously because the risk of infection is high. I don't know why. Mm. And I wasn't in a mind to ask him to explain that. Mm. But they gave me a tetanus shot. And I know your daughter had that classic, after an injection, that vagal...
Yes,
it was called vasovagal response, where your parasympathetic nervous system just inappropriately activates and you faint because your blood pressure drops.
Yeah.
I had that twice that same day. The once was in the hospital while they were doing the stitches. Because I think the guy, obviously they anesthetize it, but then the guy, I could feel the pressure of his fingers like digging in and like pulling the flap out so that he could stitch it, I guess. And I remember saying to him, I said, I think I'm going to throw up. And the room was spinning and I nearly passed out. And then in the car with you, I did.
That's right. Yeah.
On the way home.
You were just chatting and you had your Coke in your hand. Yeah. Next minute, I just saw your head drop.
And again, I felt like this wave of nausea. Mm. And then your car started like spinning. And I said, I don't feel so good at the moment. Next thing, I was being shook awake, and like in a cold sweat.
I was about to turn around and go back to the hospital.
It's
amazing how as you say, that parasympathetic system actually just kind of, I mean, I suppose it's protecting the body, isn't it? In that respect, it's shutting you down because it wants you to recover.
I mean, it's inappropriate to do it. Like the most common time you see that or know of that happening is when people donate blood or have to give blood for medical tests, whatever. And they sometimes in some people they just see a needle and they faint.
Yeah.
I knew a girl once who couldn't see blood in a picture. Like she used to sit in presentations, and if someone showed a picture of blood, she fainted in the seat sitting there. So that's obviously like a massive.
Not likely to be a doctor.
And there's no chance.
No.
There's no benefit to that. No. But in some other instances, like when it's a blood pressure related thing, fainting is good for you because it gets everything back down to level.
Mm.
And so now your heart has to pump less against gravity than it did before, and that helps.
It's interesting because they gave a rescue remedy, and then they put her legs up just to kind of...
Well, that's the key. That's the second part there. I don't know what the rescue remedy is doing, but the second part's the key.
Just to calm her down.
Yeah, it's the same thing. That vasovagal, it's the same reason soldiers on parade. There's some funny clips of ball boys and tennis fainting during long rallies because they stand in like the hot sun for a long time, and then... blood in the skin because you're trying to cool off means less blood in the center, blood pressure drops, they faint, you know. So
because your vessels are dilating, in other words they're getting bigger, therefore there's less blood volume per stroke, kind of thing.
There's more blood now in the skin circulation, which means less in the heart circulation, which means that its stroke volume drops. And so because the heart basically pumps what it has available.
I guess when somebody, I mean, it's the same thing what happened to you in the car. It's and my daughter. It's kind of scary to see fainting because it's kind of bizarre. It's somebody passing out. Watching my daughter yesterday and seeing her eyes roll back, it's slightly like almost like a fit, but not. And as you say, it is just the body's way of saying, okay, I need to lie down now.
In that instance, I mean, sometimes you'll faint because you're in the early stages of some sort of cardiac problem. Then it's different, obviously. Different ball game altogether. But
in your case, it was just your body going, okay.
Yeah, and literally you shook me awake and I said, I didn't even know that it happened.
Fine.
And within 5 seconds, I said, oof, look, I'm sweating. And within 5 seconds, I wasn't anymore and I was good to go.
Amazing, I know.
It was like a reboot almost.
Sure. Well, we hope you get better soon, because I know you haven't been on the bike for all this time. Yeah, so.
And I feel like I have to get, I need to get back on a moving bike because I know I'm going to have nerve problems now. Mm. Yeah, even now, I watch a thing on Instagram of a guy crashing, and before I used to watch him, now I actually flinch when he falls. You know what I mean? Because I'm almost post-traumatic stress. So I want to get back on the bike as soon as I can. As soon as I can grip the brake levers, I'll ride.
I'm always fascinated. I mean, I remember asking Greg Minnaar, a great downhill mountain biker, the sort of greatest of all time, many people say. But I said to him, when you crash, does that not make you more cautious next time you ride? Because I know that for myself, I've crashed a lot of times on a bike, and that's made me particularly bad on a mountain bike.
Once bitten, right?
Yeah. Mm. And he said, no, he doesn't think about that. So it's interesting to see what your reaction will be on a gravel bike, because you know the effects of a crash, and it will be fresh in your brain for now. But how long do those effects last to the point where you might take more risk
down the line? I know I'm going to be nervous the first time I'm on gravel. Like, because even the race we did the day before, like the first kilometer or two on the gravel, I was very sketchy. Mm. I felt very because I hadn't been on a gravel bike in months.
Yeah.
On the gravel anyway.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah.
But by the end of that, I felt great. Yeah. I was bombing along. And that's why I made...
Kind of in the zone.
Yeah, because it was good, and I was just annoyed. I wanted to get... The moment I crashed, I was like, I've got to get back on the bike just to pedal, you know, just to recondition.
Yeah.
Of course, my handlebar was in two pieces.
Yes.
So that didn't happen. And now I feel... But the other reason I want to exercise is just to get blood flow, because I think blood flow will accelerate that proliferation and healing, even the inflammation.
Mm. Clear out all the stuff that's in your arm.
Get some circulation going again. And because at the moment my left arm is all swollen and nasty looking.
Yeah.
And I just want to get exercise, heart rate, cardiac output, just to pump something through it, you know?
Yeah.
So, as soon as I can, I'll be back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who have fallen off anything, I'm sure you can sympathize with the Ross's situation. It is not a nice thing to crash whether you're on a skateboard or a bicycle or whatever. It's a nasty thing. Anyway, on to other subjects, talking about extreme versions. One of the stories that's caught my eye this week, in fact, it was almost 10 days ago now, but it's been doing the rounds on various social medias, is Taylor Swift's running for her Eros tour that she started a while back, where she claimed, and I say claim because I'm very suspicious about these numbers, but this has been all over runnersworld.com and of various channels, where they talked about the fact that she ran every single day for 6 months, and every day she did the equivalent of her full set. So people have worked out that the full set is 3 hours and 15 minutes. So what they were saying is she ran 3 hours and 15 minutes every day. And what she did is she ran the fast songs fast. What that means, we don't know. And the slow songs, either a light jog or a walk. When I looked at that, 3.5 hours a day for 6 months, that just sounds impossible. I mean, I'm a fan of Taylor Swift. I love her music. I think she's a great lady, and I think she's very talented. But is she that good at running that she can run 3.5 hours a day for 6 months? I mean, that is elite level stuff.
Has anyone watched a concert to see how much movement there is in the concert?
Well, I'd imagine, I mean, she is obviously in very good shape because that's her kind of vibe.
But I mean, most of that 3 hours 15, she's standing still, surely.
Yeah, but she's moving, dancing. I mean, she's obviously doing it because she also wants to look good for that concert, for that tour.
I don't know. It sounds to me like one of those things where someone said, "Yeah, you're on stage for 3 hours 15, and you do so much running," and then they've extrapolated and ended up with something completely implausible.
I mean, does it sound feasible?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah,
it sounds like the kind of thing where in 3 hours 15 of doing a concert, you might cover 5 kilometers.
Well, they're claiming that some of the Runner's World stories are saying that she was almost covering a marathon.
Not a chance. That sounds like, did a teenager write that?
No, I don't know. But
no ways.
Nobody's questioning it, which I find bizarre.
Because even if you're running on stage, I mean, and to be fair, I haven't watched one of her concerts.
No.
Have you?
Yeah, I've watched bits and pieces of concert, and she is very active, and she's dancing a lot.
But running 4 minutes, four and a half minutes a K, chance.
She's not doing that. I mean, she might not be running a marathon, but they're saying that there's been stories about how far she could run in those 3.25 hours. And if she's running really, really slowly, let's say she's running 7-8 minutes a K, you know, she's still doing 15, 20, 25 Ks.
I bet that if she was wearing a smartwatch or something and you uploaded a concert onto Strava, it wouldn't be in the double figures kilometers.
No.
It's going to be like even 10Ks, you know, like 3 kilometers an hour. Because, yeah, she might run from one end of the stage to the next before belting the chorus out. Or or she may walk constantly.
Mm.
But she's not... Okay, maybe to be charitable, 15K or something. Mm. Then...
But I don't think she's doing it because she wants to be fit on stage. She's doing it because she wants to look as good as possible on the stage. Her motivation is
distinct from what she's... Well, not what she maybe has claimed, but what the article is now extrapolated from what she said, is that she was running the equivalent of her concert. Mm. And I'm saying that the equivalent of her concert could be 12 to 15Ks.
Mm. Not a marathon. No, but even then, it's every day for 6 months.
Oh, but that's what runners will say all the time. Yeah, I run 10Ks a day. It would actually mean 5 days a week.
Yes.
And I could see that.
I
could see a healthy, fit, active person who's training, running 60K in 4 or 5 sessions a week.
Yeah, but not 3.25 hours a day.
No.
I mean, that's a long time. Even if you're doing a jog, it's a long time to be jogging.
Been lost in translation.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, and nobody seems to be Christian. I actually looked to see whether she'd come out and said, "Excuse me, people, this it wasn't like that. It was like this, and you guys have misquoted me." Because she's not saying that, but it certainly seems like there's something lost in translation. Well,
so. It's the same as when Pidcock ran a sub 14-minute 5K.
Yes,
and it was actually just a GPS issue. You know, it's like. Things that don't make sense are nonsensical for a reason.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the idea of running 3 hours 15 every day. So I could well see that she's running the equivalent of her concert distance, and her concert distance is not going to be. No. I mean, no chance.
Yeah, as opposed to maybe...
Like even an elite tennis player, like let's say, for example, because tennis seems to me, as a conversation direction this conversation is going in. Like an elite tennis player is running a couple of Ks in a match. So maybe 3 Ks in 3.5 hours. That's tennis, right? Where like you stand, you serve, you run, you cover the baseline 4 or 5 shots, you're moving left to right, you stop. It's hard to accumulate distance in such a stochastic activity.
Yeah.
So I'd be really surprised if she's accumulating a lot of distance in those 3.25 hours, even if she is highly active. And I mean, of course, like the activity is singing and dancing and so on. It's not just running and back and forth in straight lines. But I'd be very surprised. And so, yeah, she's probably running the equivalent distance, but it's not a marathon a day. No chance.
Yeah. I'm amazed at that because, I mean, my final word on it, I mean, it wasn't a story that came out of some dodgy publication. It was an interview with Time, which he claimed that. So, I don't know. You'd expect them to get the facts.
She's claimed X and they've made up the alphabet.
Maybe. But, I mean... A reporter works for Time. You'd expect to, and would interrogate the facts there and say, "What are you saying? You actually did that per day, or was it 3.5?" I don't know. I mean, it just. I'm waiting for the counter story that says actually that's not.
There won't be one. Facts don't matter when you're a brand.
I suppose not. I mean, there is interesting stories because they say that when a Taylor Swift concert comes to town, it actually moves the needle in terms of the GDP of that particular area or province or area because she brings in so much money and that it literally changes the zeitgeist.
Hasn't she single-handedly changed viewership of the NFL like to increase women viewership 20-something percent?
Well, we all know why that... dating one of the...
Travis Kelce. Yeah.
Yes. And what's the team he's a member of?
Kansas City Chiefs. So they're Super Bowl champs.
Yes. Of course, everybody, all the young fans of hers are now following that.
Yeah.
And because of his involvement with her.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Speaking of her and running and him, there was a thread on Let's Run asking basically on their chat forums, like who would win a 5K, Taylor Swift or Travis Kelce? Because he's a tight end for the Chiefs. And so He's a big, imposing athlete. He must be 120 kilograms, big guy, like built for speed and power.
Mm.
And she's obviously not built for speed and power, but maybe endurance, but not a runner. So they were asking who'd win a 5K. Love those. They always pop up on Let's Run. Those hypothetical questions.
We always talk about digressing a bit. You just alerted me to something that I watched on the Instagrams the other day. We were talking about Alex Dowsett against a professional rugby player on a watt bike. So they were trying to see what peak power they could get.
Absolute or relative?
Absolute. Okay, so flat out. correct. There was a rugby player. I think Alex Dowsett, of course, who was a former, I think he was a world champion on the time trial at one point. He got 1,200 watts or something like that. But the rugby player.
For how long? Just as a single?
I think it's just single effort. How high could they get?
Yeah.
And it was just a very short clip that he put on his channel. But
the rugby guy get 1.6.
1.597 or something like that. So it was amazing. I mean, when I saw the challenge, I thought, okay, Alex Dowsett, he's obviously got power, but he's not what he used to be 6 months ago when he was still a pro. He's certainly not in the same shape. But you're right. I mean, the rugby player absolutely trounced him in terms of absolute power. But whether you could maintain that for 5 minutes, obviously.
So the interesting thing would be my one horsepower challenge in a rugby player.
Yes, I love this.
Dowsett. So one horsepower, 746 watts.
Yes.
Basically, that's what I
think. So who would win the one horsepower challenge between those two, do you think?
Dowsett, I reckon. Just. Because that 1 minute... So the challenge would be, how long can you sustain 746 for? What's your longest period in seconds that you can average 746?
Yeah.
And I think Dowsett would do that, because those guys would be around a minute, maybe less trained, under a minute. But if he was fit, he'd be in the 2 minute range, and that's a really hard metabolic ask.
Mm.
But I just thought it funny, because like I look at my power outputs on Strava or Wahoo. And I say, okay, what's my current one horsepower number, you know?
Mm.
And where is it for other people? And it's interesting. Obviously, the smaller you are, the harder it is, right? Because, I mean, for Dowsett, that's 10 watts a kilo.
Yeah.
For a rugby player, it's 8.
Yeah.
Less, 7 and a half.
Even. Yeah.
So that's why absolute relative makes a difference. Mm. But yeah, I think the one horsepower goes back to the cyclist.
We're scrolling along here, so I apologize if we're taking ourselves into different tangents.
Yeah, indulging our end-of-year
function. Exactly. Well, stick with us. Anyway, so moving on to when we talk about world-class training, Taylor Swift's got to be up there, but if you believe it. But in terms of world-class, Valencia Marathon happened a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Reputedly one of the fastest marathons in the world. So a lot of the top professionals go there. It's not sort of one of the big majors, but it certainly is attracting very much the top end of the marathon market. And we know that one of our South African runners broke the South African record in the women's marathon and ran a sub 225 for that record that has stood for 30 odd years. But in the men's marathon, some sort of bizarre pacing, wasn't it, compared to what we normally see?
Yeah, and I didn't watch it, to be honest. You know, like, it's hard enough watching the big city marathons at the moment. But the Valencia Marathon happened, and it threw up some of the most aggressive, positive split pacing that we've seen in fast marathons. And what I mean by that is they were still fast, but they were paced really badly.
Mm-hmm.
Badly being way, way slower in the second half than the first. That's what we mean when we say positive split. So for example, when the world record was set by Kiptum earlier this year, it was a big negative split where he ran the first half in 60:48, I think it was, and the second half in 59:47. So that's a minute and 1 second faster. So we'd call that a negative 61 split.
Which is huge,
actually. Which is really big. The difference in Valencia was the winner ran a positive split of around 35 seconds. And one of the guys broke 2:05, but ran an almost 4 minutes, just over 3.5 minute positive split. So the first half was done in 1 hour, 36 seconds. And the second half, 1 hour, 4 minutes and 12 seconds.
Sure.
So it's just interesting, though, because I think for whatever reason, and I think, again, largely it's shoes related, but we've got this new standard in the marathon that has emerged in 2023. The world record now is looking like sub 2 in a proper race, not a gimmick.
Yeah, for sure.
We discussed that a couple of weeks back.
Do you think it's likely in 2024 then?
No, because the Olympics, it'll be interesting. Like, if Kiptum gets into Berlin... But you got to imagine the Kenyan, and I saw Kenya actually did announce a preliminary marathon squad, and he is in it for the Olympics.
Mm.
And if that happens, then he's got one other shot in the year, and it's London. Or actually, Kiptum's not running London; he's running in Rotterdam.
So that's a fast marathon.
It's
not world record stuff.
Maybe not. Maybe, but windy. I don't know. It depends. Hey, you get a perfect day, it's on, right? It's flat. At least, I didn't think Chicago was.
Chicago's also producing outstanding times, absolutely.
So maybe. But the problem is, I think he's got one shot at it, not two. So I'd be inclined to say, on the balance of it, he probably won't see another world record next year. Yeah. And also, I don't see other guys behind him having the same ability.
Mm.
So it's him or no one.
It's the World Record now,
2037 or 36 or something. 36, it'll be 37, right?
Yeah. So he's got a 37 seconds is what we need.
35, sorry. How's my maths? You should have added up. Yeah, it was 1 hour 48 seconds first half and 15:47. Yeah, 1 hour
35. Yeah.
Yeah, my maths wasn't so flash.
Doesn't feel like a lot, does it?
No, but it's enough, eh? I mean, and so this is why I think this caught my eye is now to match that, the guys are going to go so aggressively in the first half. Like they're going to go out in 1 hour 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because that puts you on for sub 61. And then 49 out of 50 times they're going to blow. Because it's now got to the point where, like, and Kiptum, it's amazing he's keeping that much in reserve. You know, this suggests he could maybe go a little bit faster. But these other guys that go out in sub 61, sub 60, 30 even, to try and break that world record, you're going to see a lot of performances like this where they just get slow and slow in the second half. So I think there's a new pattern emerging in a marathon where it's going to be like everyone, six or seven guys reach halfway on course and it's last man standing. And the women will be the same, by the way, because remember this year we saw a sub 2:12 marathon from a woman, which is insane. Insane. So how are they going to break that? You've got to go 66 minutes through halfway. For most women, that's a half marathon PB.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting talking to our own South African marathon champion after she broke the record in Valencia. And I said to her, and I've actually asked this question before, I said, to be truly competitive and to give yourself the best chance of running your best time in a marathon, do you have to risk failure to ultimately succeed? So in other words, do you have to risk going out too fast and blowing up? Or do you run with the idea of always finishing? In other words, you know, do you go out there being conservative, pacing yourself correctly so that you, most importantly, if you run a good time, but you always want to finish? And she said that that was a big mental step for her to think about it like that, because for her, when she was running Olympic Games, for instance, she felt like that. Did she go with the break? Could she have gone with the break? If she did, would she blow up down the line? And I think to some extent, is it, and I guess I'm getting to the question, if you're going to go and break sub 2 hours, you have to go out, I would assume, on a sub 1 hour pace to stand a chance of breaking sub two, ideally. Because because is it only possible to do a negative split potentially, or is it?
No. So like, let's say Kiptum now. So he does 48 first half. He'll be looking at his next one and saying, right, let's go 60 to 30.
Right.
And then still repeat the second half. But can he? I don't know.
So you wouldn't want to think sub 60 and then hold on and see if I can just break sub 60 again. So give himself some time in the bag.
I think you'd want to try and finish stronger, you know. You'd want to always try and finish with a fast last 10Ks. But it's fragile, right? Because what's the difference between 60:48 and 60:25?
Yeah.
It's 1 second a kilometer.
1 second a kilometer, yeah.
I can handle that. But that 1 second a kilometer might cost you 3 seconds a K in the second half. And that's what we saw in Valencia. It's like guys would have gone through the first half in 60:30. So on course for sub 2:01. And you're looking at that, you know, they're going through halfway 10, 15 seconds faster than Kiptum did.
Yeah.
So now actually that world record is on. But the ability to recreate the pacing strategy of Kiptum, that's what's going to trip him up. So it's going to be interesting, right? Because in this particular race, okay, it was 1:201.40, the Lemma from Ethiopia.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yep, yeah. On any start line, there'll be three or four guys who could run that, but none of them can run it off the back of a 60:30. Is one of them going to understand that and say, you go, I'll come from the back and finish stronger? Because I reckon you'll start seeing, because of the shift in marathon running and how aggressive it's going to get, I think more marathons in future will be won from the second group, potentially. But that depends on race organizers, because if I send my group one out at 60:30 halfway pace, or 60 maybe, because let's go sub two, 60 and see who survives, if the top eight all go with that, then no one's coming from behind because the ninth best guy's not good enough. But if one of those top five or six says, no, I'm going to go 61, I think you're going to see a lot of like marathons where it actually gets quite exciting. People are caught in the last 5 or 6K because they're all blowing up and one guy is not because he's the only sensible guy in the race. Mm.
I mean, when I think about it in terms of races competing against races for the sort of glory, I mean, seeing so many world records broken this year, I can't really keep track of when the world record is broken. Yeah, but to be the first race that has a sub-2-hour marathon will be huge because it will be a bit like sub-4-minute mile.
Yeah,
Oxford, you know, track. Everybody will always remember that particular race. Yeah. It doesn't matter what happens after that. It's going to be that first sub-2-hour marathon. So I'd imagine there's a huge amount of goings on behind the scenes at all the marathons around the world right now, where they're thinking, "How could we do this? We want to be the first race to break sub-2 hours because the exposure will be enormous."
Yeah, and there's only everlasting 4 or 5 candidates, right?
Yeah,
Berlin, Valencia, Chicago has to be in that. Maybe one of the Dutch ones and one of the Middle Eastern races. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. As long as they have it in the middle
of
the night.
But yeah, it's going to be, it's just interesting because like I do think we're 2023 will go down as like obviously a double world record year and incredible world record, especially on the women's side. Unheard of to think that a woman can run 2 sub-66 marathons. Mm. Okay, and she didn't. She also ran a massive sub-60, I think it was 65 on one of those hours. I forget now. But point is, there will be this aggressive pacing now to try and break that world record, and that's going to create opportunities for other athletes, I think.
Do you think do you think the women's equivalent of that 2-hour marathon is a 2:10? In other words, a sub-2:10. I mean, is that?
No, they're a long way off that, though.
Yeah, they are. But do you think it's fair to say that's the equivalent of a sub-2-hour men's marathon?
Well, back in the day,
I think it's a bit unfair to give that.
When was the first sub-2-hour gimmick? It was Monza.
Oh, 2019. Was it before COVID? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was. It was like a year before COVID.
Yeah.
So 18, 19-ish. There was an article that was published then saying that the women's equivalent of a sub-2 had already been run, and that was Paula Radcliffe's time.
That's right.
That's minutes slower than what we saw happen this year. So in actual fact, if that logic is applied, and I don't think that logic was true, I think it's been shown up a little bit, then this 2:11:53 that we saw earlier this year is way under the men's 2-hour equivalent. Wow. But it's not. It's not. I mean,
I suppose difficult to compare.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, I just, 2:11, crazy.
Mm.
So what did Gerda Steyn run? The South African
2:24,
record?
Just under 2:25.
I mean, that's like, and she 20, was at, 20, almost 20 seconds a K.
What's frightening about that's that, incredible. I mean, that was a South African record that had stood for Milana Mayer's days almost 30 years ago. 29 years ago, and that was, I mean, it was obviously an outstanding time, but she was only 11th in the race. I mean, she wasn't even in the top 10 with that race. I mean, it was brilliant, but it wasn't even on the radar.
And that's where
that's Valencia. It's not one of the big ones like New York.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's where you'll see interesting like game theory. It's almost poker now being played out. Like, what do I do? You know, and that's the question you put to her: is what do I do here? If she goes out, she's running 2:24, right? If she goes out in 70, she could run 2:28. You know?
Yeah.
She could blow up massively and run an 8-minute positive split.
Yes.
But if she goes out in 71:30, she can come 11th. But if she's tempted to go out in 70:30, she could come 8th. And what's the prize money difference versus the risk of blowing up?
Mm.
That's the calculus that's now going to have to be made, right? Mm.
And that's where she is.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do I do? I mean, what do? You've broken the South African record. She's broken the two records of the biggest ultras here in South Africa this year. And then, so what's the next step? The next step is to take that risk.
So I have a 10% chance of running 2:22,
or
I have a 90% chance of running 2:24.
Yeah.
Which one's better for me to go for today? Yeah.
I know what I would do, but I'm not an elite athlete.
But again, it depends. Like, you'd take the 90% chance.
I'd take the risk.
You take the risk?
I'd take the risk. Especially if you've broken the South African record.
Yeah, maybe.
You've got to give yourself a chance. You've got to say, right, I would train for a 2:22.
You've got to remember always, like, there's a risk and then there's the reward against that risk, right? Yeah. So if the reward for the 90% chance of running 2:24 is to come 11th, then you've got to take the risk because there's actually no reward.
And I suppose in training, you know what you can and cannot do. She knows, but maybe potentially that she can't run 5 seconds quicker.
Yeah, so it's one of those where in the marathon, it's simultaneously interesting and really boring times. Because I'll be honest, the marathon bores me a lot at the moment.
Yeah, I struggle.
Really struggle to lift myself to get excited like I used to.
Mm. That's because of the pacing. It's one runner in the front. There's not much racing going on.
Yeah.
Hopefully, once this two-hour mark has been broken, and whenever that is, we will see more racing and maybe the elimination of pace setters and that sort of thing. I hope that they will do that one day. Because racing for me is much more entertaining than just seeing a fast time. But
best marathon of the year was New York. You know, they have no pacemakers because they know it's not going to be super fast.
Yeah, and so
the
women's is another
the
one.
Women's race in New York was really, really good for that reason.
Yeah, and that's the same thing applies to the Olympic marathon in 2024. Yeah. Those are the marathons that I'll watch because they are races. There's no pace setting.
With you.
Anyway, so next one on other news. Well, we did it on a podcast about this a couple of podcasts back on the turtle and the water immersion story, and that was fascinating because some of the preliminary sort of research coming out of that was that this cold water immersion, of course, Wim Hof being the man whose name is behind most of this kind of science, or maybe we could even say pseudoscience. I mean, there was question marks about that first bit of research to say, well, you know, was it done properly? But it certainly didn't show cold water immersion favorably. But now new research coming out about particularly performance bases.
Yeah, this was a study that was published earlier this year in the Journal of Sports Science. And I suppose the reason you do this is because oftentimes athletes are faced with a challenge where they've got to produce two really big efforts within a few hours of one another. And the question is, in the gap in between those efforts, what's the best way to recover and then rebound? Because if you have more than a day and you've got a couple of hours, then I think it's largely agreed that like some cold water immersion, get the inflammation down, aids recovery and allows you to then perform better in the next bout. In contrast, if you want training adaptations, the inflammation is part of the stress that drives the adaptation. So when you are in a training block and you are trying to get fitter, stronger, better, cold water immersion might shut off adaptation. Makes sense, right?
Right. Yeah.
And this is kind of like they're testing the extreme where you've only got a couple of hours. And so what they did was with ice skaters at national level, so pretty good athletes, they did an exhaustive ice skating training session. And then the participants then either did hot water immersion, so that's heat therapy, cold water immersion, or active recovery. And then after 90 minutes, so in other words, the first session finishes 90 minutes later, they do a repeated sprint cycle session. And the outcome of interest is power output in that cycle. And what they find is that the active recovery group and the hot water immersion group produce higher power outputs in that sprint cycling session than the group that did the cold water immersion. So the cold water immersion seems to then affect your subsequent exercise when it's close enough to the bout.
Yeah.
And they find that there was a relationship between the muscle temperature during recovery and the maximal power output. So in other words, the cold water immersion cooled the muscles down. So it worked. But that then means that you've got cooler muscles when you have to then sprint, and that's not good.
Kind of logical, though.
Yeah, fairly. Mm. There's always like the search for the trade-off is like cooling off and getting the inflammation down might allow you to actually produce better power output later, you know, recover faster, be fresher, like effectively reset for the next bout. But this study suggests that doesn't work. So if you've only got up to an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, you wouldn't want to cool the athlete is what this is saying. The implication for this that's interesting, and I shared it with an elite athlete who we will soon release a podcast with, is that they've explored, he's an elite mountain biker, they've explored cold water immersion before races. And this would suggest that you do not want to do that either, because the direct cooling of the muscle is what compromises your muscle ability, right?
Mm.
So you'll often see athletes wearing ice vests or trying to stay cool with fans and cold water over the head and pouring. The other method that's quite common is to ingest a slushy, like the ice. What's interesting about that is it has to be solid. It can't be cold liquid because it's the process of that melting from solid slushy into liquid that actually causes the heat drop in your body temperature. Okay. So the athlete wants to be cooler, but you don't want to be muscles and skin to be cold. So that's the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just, I mean, as you'll, I mean, the podcast we're doing, which is coming up, we will get that out early in 2024. But he actually talked a little bit about the fact that he does is exactly like that in terms of if he was doing repeated racing,
yeah,
then you would use the cold water immersion to recover. But if he's doing repeated bout exercise sessions, he doesn't want to eliminate that adaptation.
Like someone in a high intensity.
That's critical to understand when you use it.
Right. So for instance, if you're in a high intensity stage race, Cape Epic, or if you are a cyclocross rider, okay, I don't think, you see, there's not massive muscle damage in those events anyway. So you might, you think that the benefit's probably quite small. But those are the kinds of situations where cold water would be potentially beneficial. The moment you are in a situation where you don't need to perform, but you need to training, you need to adapt to training, you don't want cold. And if the moment you need to perform soon after, you also don't want cold. So there's a window of opportunity, depending on your incentives, that probably drives your decision. Yeah. And that's true around all inflammation. We spoke a little bit in the context of my own wounds about inflammation. That's true for taking anti-inflammatories. They probably blunt your training response. You could not waste time, but you could be getting less bang for your buck if you trained on anti-inflammatories than you would without them.
Yeah. Interesting. Another one that's come up and is always controversial is the ketogenic diet, which for those of you that follow Professor Tim Noakes, of course, Ross Tucker's mentor a few years back, a couple of decades back. And,
just one decade. One and a bit decades.
But I mean, this is always an interesting one because the ketogenic diet is very much in vogue at the moment. And there are those out there who promote the fact that it's the best way to go and there's carnivore diets and all that sort of thing. But now there's some research and some debate, but the research is kind of contradicting each other, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, so the Journal of the American College of Sports Medicine is called MSSE. It's Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, pretty well-known journal. And they published, the way that I gather it from the sequence, is that Tim Noakes wrote an article called Ketogenic Diets are Beneficial for Athletic Performance. That was December 2023. I'll share these links. That the journal then obviously decided they would invite a contrasting perspective. And so Louise Burke, who's a exercise physiologist and nutritionist from Australia, wrote a piece together with Jamie Whitfield saying ketogenic diets are not beneficial for athletic performance. And then Tim obviously responds to that with a subsequent saying.
So where can you find that? Is that debate then on the MSSE?
Yeah, Medicine, Science and Sports and Exercise. You may need a subscription to it because it's one of these where you've got to buy the paper specifically. Right. It might be a while yet before it's available through the sort of the freer ones. I haven't read them yet myself because this came out after, I haven't read anything on a computer screen for a while, but...
Why is there a debate? This is what I don't get about the ketogenic style, because from what I understand of it, there's the big move towards carbs and endurance sports in particular, because carbs fuel the body and you need to fuel the body when you're exercising. So if you're not fueling the body, you're only relying on protein and that sort of thing. You can't fuel. But so I'm struggling to understand. Surely the science speaks for itself in this situation. In other words, the body needs that. You have to have that, therefore you can't do that. And I understand how you can use ketogenic diets if you're training at a low intensity level and you can go for hours and burn fat and drink milk for your water bottle. But
Well, I think,
feel like that to you, in other words?
I think, though, you know how it's been for the last decade, especially here in South Africa with banting and the ways that it's been applied, is the line between scientific and ideological position is quite difficult to tell apart sometimes, right? And so I think that's what's happened, is that there's probably one or two lines of evidence suggesting that ketogenic diets are healthier in some circumstances for some people, and that some athletes in some contexts can get away with ketogenic diets. But then that becomes their beneficial for performance, which is quite a different claim. And I think the difference between the claim and the evidence is ideology. I think people want them to be beneficial. Because meanwhile, what's happening in the real world of elite athletes is that they are shifting to say, used to be we said 60 grams an hour, now it's 90, 100, 120, 140. The more carbs we can get in, the better we will perform. And that is what they are doing because it works. You know, like I've often spoken, like there's a certain Darwinian reality to elite sport, is that they test everything and what works persists and what doesn't becomes extinct.
Yeah.
Those athletes have tried ketogenic diets. You know they have. guarantee you.
Yeah.
In like this time of year, 100%. Wherever they are in their training camps in the south of Spain, Italy, here in Stellenbosch, athletes are tinkering and trying out different things. And they very quickly discover that they cannot sustain the intensity or the volume or both of training on that diet. And they say, right, let's try something else. And eventually they find the thing that becomes widely used. And that thing is the carbs. So even in the real world, the application tells you what's happening.
Yeah.
But the evidence, and Louise Burke, incidentally, has got a couple of quite good studies on carb restriction in elite athletes doing high-intensity training. A lot of them are race walkers. Now, race walkers are not like track cyclists. They're not even Tour de France cyclists where it's a 20-minute effort at close to VO2 max or very high intensities. But even there, they're showing pretty solidly that race walkers become less efficient. Their performance goes down when you restrict carbohydrates. And that's the basis for her response to Tim's article. I haven't read these two myself, so I'm not sure how Tim is going to try and argue this. But in the elite, in the world of elite athletes, the carbs are non-negotiable.
Yeah. And to some extent, they're also non-negotiable for anybody that's relatively serious about their sport in any, in respects, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I'll share the two links, and you can, if you have access to the papers, I'll get access. This was literally published a week ago, and so even my university affiliation doesn't have them yet. It takes a couple of weeks, so we'll read them at some stage. And Louise is someone we've had discussions with her about getting on the podcast, actually, and maybe in 2024 we need to try and make that happen. You know, because it'll be good to hear it from her, her own evidence for it.
And she's at the forefront of much of the nutrition run sport, isn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. And that's why I'm inclined to believe someone who's spent 30, 40 years studying effectively evolution of nutrition. You know, the Darwin thing. Like she's,
like when we were cavemen, we used to go out and hunt animals and never eat vegetables. Come on, man.
That's what they say. But that's like, I promise you, that's the same thing as Taylor Swift's 3 hours, 15 marathon. It's one of those stories that like just gets amplified in its retelling.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, when we were cavemen, but then we didn't run 60-minute half marathons.
No.
Didn't have bicycles back then either. And who's to say it was optimal? We did it, but it wasn't optimal. We could probably do it now, but you wouldn't want to
race. Well, the caveman story is that they're probably going for a long, long time at a low intensity.
Extremely low.
Yeah.
Like sort of 20 Ks over 6 hours.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to be... It's interesting to see how this always develops, because Professor Tim Noakes is very polarizing in some respects. I mean, he's got his own on Instagram. There's a Tim Noakes Foundation page and all sorts of things. So, you know, sometimes I read this, and even despite our discussions, I look at this and go, ah, maybe there is something in this. And then you look at the facts and you go, no, there isn't. And there's so much this, you know, even if you're absolutely clued up in all the science, it's hard to sometimes ignore some of the benefits. And there are so many people out there that are promoting it. You know, they're a bit like ex-smokers. You know, they once they're on that sort of carnivore diet. I mean, we've seen local athletes in South Africa. Mariska Strauss is a top athlete, being on a podcast the other day talking about the fat, how it's changed her life and etc. But she's a competitive athlete.
What does she race on then? What's in her
water bottle? That's the point. She's been sick with a heart issue for a while, and now she's gone into this sort of ketogenic a carnivore diet. But she hasn't raced since she's been on that diet, so that's going to be interesting, because if she comes back to a competitive space, how competitive is she going to be? And I think that will be the true test. Is she going to be able to go out there and race with the very best at the epic and around, you know, cross-country courses? Or...
I mean, there are studies that show that recovery and mood state, subjective and objective markers of recovery are significantly worsened when you train on a low-carb diet. Even when you're doing not necessarily race intensity training sessions, but in those blocks that athletes would be maybe doing right now, where they're doing relatively high volume with a little bit of intensity, like sort of sprinkled in, your ability to recover from that, you know, when you're on the bike for 5-6 hours and you're doing that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that's after 2-3 weeks, I would be very surprised if that's sustainable. So whenever athletes say that, like, I wonder whether they're saying my habitual diet is this, but actually, when you start looking at it, when they need it, and when we did our nutrition podcast with Graham Close, his catchphrase was fuel for the work at hand. And so when Strauss or anyone is doing those high intensity sessions, where the, you know, the carb oxidation rate could be in the grams per hour, like now, per minute, sorry, not hour, obviously per hour, Maybe they're fueling it with carbs. So actually they are still putting carbs in because they know they need it. But habitually they might still be ketogenic. And that, no one ever probes that.
Mm.
Instead you create this picture that this is an athlete who never touches a carb.
Yeah.
I don't buy that.
Mm.
Don't buy it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you can train low under some circumstances, get away with it. But when you compete and when you train hard, you have to be high in carbs.
But we know, as we have discussed in the podcast, a couple of podcasts back, that if you train low, you don't allow your gut to become used to a high carb situation, which is now what many of the top athletes are doing. So you have to train your gut
so that's
as
why
much as you...
You'd want to say to Mariska Strauss, like, what does it look? Show me your hardest session of the week, that Wednesday when you went out and did 8 times 3 minutes at like way above your VO2 max equivalent power, or the 4x8, you know, like we know is a session they commonly use. What's your fuel utilization look like? Your fuel consumption look like there? Maybe once a week is enough to train it, and they're getting 60 to 80 grams. And when they compete in the epic or whatever, they can get away with that. But I just don't see.
Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that one always, because it is something that is continually moving and shaking, even though the evidence always supports the fact that we probably need more carbs than we think. So look at the science when you're out there doing your sport over this festive season. Anyway, moving on to our next subject, and this is something that has been a bit of a theme of the Science of Sport podcast over the last couple of years, and that's all around talent identification. And we've done podcasts in the past around where people who are talented sportsmen are most likely to come from, whether they come from big towns and small towns. Turns out small towns probably favor big towns in that respect. But now there's new research coming out showing the proliferation. I think a lot of people who have talented children will go, what is the likelihood of my son, daughter, of being able to go out and be a professional sportsman if they're showing talent at a young age? In other words, 13, 14, they're top of the pile. And are they going to become professionals by the time they're 21, 22? So what is the latest saying about that?
Yeah, so the latest is not actually original research. It's a systematic review and meta-analysis, which is kind of in the research considered to be the gold standard, because what the researchers do here is they create quite stringent requirements for including versus excluding papers. And so you end up with what you hope is the best quality research, and then you aggregate that research using a variety of tools and methods to try and come up with one finding out of 40-odd studies, more if you're lucky. And so this was a systematic review that was published in Sports Medicine, and it's called Effects of Early Talent Promotion on Junior and Senior Performance, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And so what they do is they find a collection of studies that in the end comprises 6,233 athletes. So, you know, each study might be a couple hundred, but now you aggregate, you get power.
This is a proper sample size, isn't it?
Yeah. And so the central finding, and I'm reading this from the results of the paper, the central finding is that the effects on short-term junior performance versus long-term senior performance are opposite, right? Whereby higher performing junior athletes begin talent promotion programs at younger ages than low performing athletes. In contrast, higher performing senior athletes begin talent promotion programs at older ages than lower performing senior athletes. Now, I suppose the question is, what's a talent promotion program? Would be any deliberate investment that you make into a young person's coaching and talent development. So sending them to an academy would be the obvious one. Putting them in programs where they are now effectively junior elite athletes. Programs that are intended to accelerate the development of talent are less likely to produce high-performing senior athletes, more likely to produce high-performing junior athletes. So it's a you can have it here and now if you invest young, or you can have it delayed, but it's less likely the younger you invest. That's what that's saying. And that's so this caught my eye, because as you know, like this year I started working with that running academy, and we would be a talent promotion program, because we go around the country and we try and find kids from disadvantaged backgrounds and we put them in a school situation and we give them coaching and nutritional support and in the hopes of trying to accelerate their development. And this study is warning us that if we're not careful, we will be very good at producing good 17, 18-year-olds, but not very good at producing good adults. And which do we want?
And do we know, do they suggest why that might be? In other words, are there so many factors?
There's a few things, and some of them are cause and some of them are not, you know. The one obvious one is that the people who get the investment are the wrong people.
In other words, the early maturers, for instance.
And so you put all your eggs in the wrong basket. Mm. Or you put the wrong eggs in the right book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because what happens then is that you invest resources, expertise, human coaching, equipment, competition, etc., financial, into athletes whose ceiling actually is going to be reached when they're 17, 18.
Right.
And so they look like really good junior athletes because they got all the good stuff. You know, they got all the resources. But they probably hit their ceiling and they never go beyond that. Meanwhile, the athletes who may have gotten delayed maturation, delayed growth, come through and then end up being better seniors despite not having that access to early resources, just because their potential level, their ceiling was higher. Mm. So it might be that you make the wrong selection in terms of who gets to go into them. The other thing, which is maybe scarier, but in a sense reassuring because it can be controlled, is that your actual act of promoting talent undermines them by investing in the wrong things, potentially putting too much pressure on young athletes, focusing on the wrong outcomes. And that's what the message to the coaches that I work with is: we need to be careful, because if we don't set the finish line for adulthood and we make our objective producing good young athletes, then we will actually just contribute another data set to the study.
Yeah.
And so what do we want to do? So like, there is definitely an element where young athletes who are pushed young into specializing in talent programs are less likely to be active as adults. They're more likely to give the sport up the moment they get independence and autonomy, because they actually just, you know, they're tired of being elite athletes when they're 17 years old. So they stop. And so you want to make sure that you focus on the right things potentially to keep them viable for longer. That's the key.
I think sometimes it's also like, having had three children and seeing my elder sons going through the process of sport and that sort of thing, that there's often a case where you get the expectations of the parents that put so much pressure on a child when they're young. So they're pushing those expectations. They want their mom and dad to be proud of them, therefore they do. By the time they get to a point where they're making their own decisions, they're not then capable of maintaining that motivation, because it's a different motivation. So it's interesting, because, I mean, if you look at that study, how do you then change it with the program that you're working on? Because you are looking at young talent. Where do you find young talent if it's not with the people that are performing at that level? I mean, it's a complex solution, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't. I mean, because you can only pick based on what they're capable of today. Otherwise, you might as well just go random. You might as well just pick a phone book up and say, okay, from this town, we're picking three people. We're going to open the phone book and throw darts at the pages and say, we're going to use you. But you can't. You have to try and reward current performance as the predictor of future performance. And then you're in that trap potentially, right? So, but as long as you know it's there, maybe you can try and like minimize its effects. But then the main thing is to just promote like that you, among the coaches, that you make decisions that are based on what will be best for the athlete when they're 23. Not when they're 16, 17.
And again, the differences.
There are a few like that.
The differences also between the sexes are very significant, because generally girls mature ahead of boys. So a 14, 15 year old girl will potentially be as closer to being fully grown and mature versus a boy of that age who might put on another 5 or 6 kilos or lose 5 or 6 kilos, or if he's heavy, be the same as somebody else who's 21. So.
And I mean, we're lucky in a sense. It's not luck, because it's by design. It's Ilana's design. So that we don't take a 13 or 14 year old athlete and then take their scholarship away at 15, 16 because they're not performing. Their school scholarship is guaranteed till they finish school. And the program has very much been set up to say, like, actually, you know what? We want you to just finish in a way better school than you might otherwise have had access to. Potentially get yourself a scholarship to a US or a South African university/college. And then the program will be successful, even if you don't end up running faster at 18 than you were at 15. And that happens, by the way, especially in the girls, because you can't really predict the direction maturation is going to take the body.
Yeah.
Right? And you would have known many examples of someone who's in this fabulous looking young athlete at 14, 15, and they just never quite kick on. We don't kick them out for that reason. We work with them until they finish school. And then you say, okay, it's still successful because they got into a university set up because of their academic and school performance. So we're not under the same pressure like an academy would be at a football club in England, where if a kid is not making it from 14 into 15s into 16s, they actually get discarded. We don't have to worry about that. So luckily for us. We don't have to worry about
that. I mean, can you potentially create, using some of the data that you can see from successful senior athletes, and create an algorithm that suggests and looks at the potential of an athlete? So, for instance, Ilana Meyer, silver medalist at the Olympic Games, one of the great half marathoners around the world, great marathoner as well. In other words, she was a talented young athlete. Yeah. She's moved through the system. She became a good senior as well. What made her there? And then creating a whole sense of data points. Zola Budd, for instance, is another one. You can create a data point there. Where did she start? In other words, could you create something which you could plug into a system and say, right, this person matches the criteria of potentially being a good senior. Therefore, we can push them even though they're not necessarily showing youthful potential.
The best thing I can think of there is you want to be able to say that to be a good adult athlete, let's say in the middle distance now, since you've picked up Zola and Ilana's examples, you need someone who's going to be happy and capable of training for 15 to 20 hours a week at the age of 21. So how do we create that person, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe the things you do to create a very successful 16, 17-year-old are less likely, in fact, are likely to reduce the chances that person's going to be happy to do that. So you've got to play the long game. You know, and Ilana always talks about it as well. She says, to make a good middle distance athlete, you've got to think like it's a 6 to 8 year project. And so if we pick up a 14-year-old girl or boy, we have to be thinking about what that person's like at 2022. And you don't make decisions. You don't make changes. You don't load. You know, you get an athlete who hasn't run faster at 15 than they were at 14. You don't ramp the training volume up because they're not responding to training. You just play the long game and you say, let's be patient about this. And let's, we want you to be running and training when you're 21, 22. Then you can make the call, you know? And then I suppose there's a philosophical conversation. Like, does it really matter if you were a good 17-year-old but not a good adult? I suppose not really.
No.
Like why must the objective be to make great adults? What you definitely don't want is someone who's a great junior and who does no sport at all from the age of 21 onwards, because they just actually hate sport. Because then you get inactive, unhealthy adults with negative relationships.
And that often happens when they're young, talented, and they lose it.
They get driven so much by parents. And actually, you mentioning that, there was a really good incoming. There was a really good interview, like a snippet of an interview with Padraig Harrington, the golfer, that did the rounds on social media this week. And I'll try and find it and put it up. And basically, it was him giving his advice to parents of kids who want their kids to be good golfers. And the fundamental message is, like, you could do, if you did nothing other than buy your son or daughter a Coke after they've played a bit of golf on a Saturday morning, that would be enough, because they would associate golf with positive things. And every time they played from then on, they would have that association with time with mom, time with dad, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, make it fun, make it fun. I mean, and it's funny because we did a podcast on this, and I remember the social medias, there were a few people saying, oh, this is just woke PC nonsense.
Yeah.
It's actually not. This is the high performance advice, is make it fun.
Make it fun.
That's the high performance advice. Your 14, 15-year-old kid, if they're not having fun, they're less likely to be high performance athletes.
Yeah.
And Padraig Harrington says this in this little 2-minute sermon, which I must post for you, because he says it really well. I thought it was pretty impressive.
And we've talked about the fact that we look at the Tiger Woods examples versus the Roger Federer examples.
Yeah, and we get misled.
Yeah, we misled. Yeah. We always believe those are the successful. Starting Venus Williams, the Williams sisters, starting when they're 5 years old. Those are actually the outliers, whereas most successful sports people start later in life.
Yeah, and you don't know that they came that way. But I'll tell you one thing is, Tiger must have had fun. Whatever way Tiger had fun as a kid, he must have still been having fun,
because
he wouldn't have kept going.
Well, you see some of his
pathology.
Yeah, but you see some of his interaction with his son Charlie, where there's a lot of fun between the two of them. And Charlie's obviously a very talented golfer in himself. There's some amazing footage on the interwebs about that. But there's a sense that Tiger Woods has ingrained that sense of joy in the game.
Yeah, and the joy might be the challenge.
Yeah. But he's fun to watch, like Charlie Woods. Yeah.
But that's the key. Is like if they see a challenge and they want to rise to it, then by all means. But it has to be their challenge, to quote something 100%. From the All Black mantra. And it's fun and challenge and stimulating and just facilitating opportunities. But the moment your expectations are transferred or your challenge becomes theirs, I think you lose young people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the key. And I know it sounds PC, but it actually is the truth.
So before we get on to our sort of picks of the year, a final, I mean, we have talked about a lot this year and it has been one of the themes because of the Rugby World Cup, but there's a new head guard that's potentially out there to, what they're saying, this particular manufacturer, is that this is a chance of preventing concussions.
Yeah.
And the background, of course, is that there has been some discussion about the fact that American football helmets prevent concussions, which they've since discovered is not necessarily true. In fact, it might make them worse. But is there any merit in the fact that these head guards are going to do a better job than...
Not yet.
Nothing really. There's nothing else doing it.
Not yet. But I was actually involved in a conversation this morning with someone who asked about this, because this was a piece that was published a couple of weeks ago in The Guardian. New head guard brings hope of game-changing safety breakthrough. And it's a company in the UK, not the first company in the UK or in the world who's claimed that they've got head guards. Remember, head guards in rugby are different from helmets because it's a soft shell, one-layered thing. And what the article basically says is this company is ready to go to market and they're just waiting for World Rugby's approval. Now, World Rugby isn't quick to approve equipment like this because there's two problems or risks. One is that it doesn't work and it's sold as something that works, but it doesn't. And
then this particular one, you don't know that
any equipment, basically any protective equipment. What if it doesn't work? Is the first question.
Yeah, but
right?
Then you don't know what the results of this.
No,
particular
you don't know any of them.
Yeah,
which is the dilemma we'll get onto shortly. Mm. And then the second problem is, what is the risk of that device to opponents? You know, like you could put a helmet on and say it protects me, but I'm going to injure all of you blokes. So World Rugby has to be quite careful. Shoulder pads is the same kind of thing, you know, like, and even like GPS units that used to fit behind the, well, they still do now because they were eventually approved, but having a hard piece of plastic, is that going to pose a risk to other? So the point is, it's not just, yeah, by all means, go ahead, let's try it out. You have to be a little bit cautious about equipment. Mm. The problem is, and where this gets frustrating, is that until it is shown to have a benefit, it's not approved, but it'll never be approved until it's shown to have a benefit. So we are stuck in a catch-22 of our own desire to have evidence.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. And so one of the earliest manifestations or illustrations of why we believe the mouth guards are so beneficial, this is the instrument of mouth guards that measure head acceleration, is because as it stands right now, without those mouth guards, to study whether a head guard works, you would have to take a group of literally hundreds, if not thousands of players. Mm. And for 2 years, maybe, you'd have to track them. And you'd have to measure how many tackles the players make with head guards, without head guards. How many times did a player get concussed with head guards and without head guards? Because only then can you work out the true risk of the head guard versus not having the head guard, or benefit.
Yeah.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There were, let's say for argument's sake, there were 17,000 tackles made by players without head guards and 3,200 with head guards. And of those 17,000, there were X concussions, and in the 3,200, there were Y concussions. Which one's higher? But now that's a 2-year-long study with hundreds of players, and it's just nothing. It's just the whole thing is going to grind to a halt, you know? Mm. The thing about mouth guards is that we can now measure in 30 matches, we can have 20,000 head impacts. And of those 20,000 head impacts, 250 will be relatively significant. So now in 20 matches, we can get an indirect answer to that question without having to wait for the concussions to happen, to whether the head guard slows the head down.
Mm.
Theoretically, if the head guard slows the acceleration of the head down, it'll protect against concussions.
Mm.
If it doesn't, it won't. And that's always been the problem, right?
That's the definition of a concussion, is the speed at which the head is accelerated or decelerated.
Consequence of the acceleration of the head, because either linearly or rotationally, excessive acceleration of the head is going to cause those forces inside the brain. So it's a consequence of it. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, okay.
So we're in a position now where, thanks to the mouth guards, we can potentially study quite quickly the answer to claims, we can test the veracity of claims like this. Our head guard prevents concussions. Well, we're not going to measure whether it prevents concussions. We're going to measure whether it reduces head acceleration and prevents the highest head accelerations in the game. We're going to have 20 matches with head guards, 20 matches without, or 15 and 15, whatever, and measure that. Yeah, that's the kind of question we can now attempt to answer. Because historically, the head guards are very good at preventing impact-related injuries, abrasions and skull fractures and that sort of thing. But they haven't been very good at preventing concussions, mostly because the concussion happens inside the skull as a result of movement of the brain inside the head. And that's not something a head guard's ever affected.
Mm.
And many will say, well, these ones won't either. And quite possibly that's true. But my counterpoint is that 5 years ago, we never had shoe cushioning that was both elastic and shock absorptive. And now we do. And look what it's done to running. Why can't new tech and innovation in materials produce something that is both cushioning and dampening to head acceleration? I don't see it as completely beyond the realms of possibility, but they have to be tested, because at the moment this piece here just creates this expectation that it works, and it's never been tested. I read this article, I said, this is news to me.
Yeah, and you're working in the space.
I'm working in the space. I'm with World Rugby, and they're saying in this article they're just waiting the green light of approval for governing body World Rugby.
Yeah.
That if there was a green light, and that's a question mark, it wouldn't be approval, it would be to test it, because they still haven't got the injury surveillance study that shows that this thing works. It's a claim, it's not a reality.
Yeah.
And so but then at the same time, I can appreciate from the perspective of the head guard manufacturer, they're saying, why are you so slow? Well, we're so slow because it's going to take years to answer it if we study concussions. But the mouth guard, we might be able to put this research into hyperdrive and do something really quickly. So maybe that's something that starts happening next year. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if there is some evidence that comes out of that.
I mean, I was just the week before the cycling trip, ill-fated cycling, I was in New York for a meeting with NFL and other collision sports. They really do believe that the helmets in the NFL make a difference. And even now they've got another contraption that makes the players look like characters in a Mario Brothers TV game, where they put the helmet on and then there's a external cap on the outside of it, like a soft shell on the outside. It's called the Guardian cap. And they reckon that Guardian cap, which they use in preseason, has reduced the concussion risk quite considerably there as well. So they're exploring new tech and new ways to incorporate that kind of concept into helmets. And their top biomedical engineer is a guy called Jeff Crandall, a really interesting, entertaining and impressive guy. And he reckons that in rugby, if you just gave him a little bit of space, he could make headgear that reduced the concussion risk. Because that's always been the problem, is it's not enough of a scaffold to cause the head acceleration to change. And he says, oh, I could do this, you know, football helmets do it. So they really believe that helmets are the way to go, and they are committed to that, and they've got what they believe is solid evidence for it. In rugby, it hasn't worked, but he reckons that it's not inconceivable.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I must say, one of those things where, I think it's one of those things where there's continuous debate, and there's obviously this pressure on, as we talked about before, on rugby and on various NFL's team, where they're actually having to be in a situation where they want to make sure that they're looking after the safety of the players, because in the long term they don't want people coming back to them to say you didn't do enough. And I think rugby's trying to do enough, and obviously the NFL's in the same boat, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly the same, and with evidence, right? So that's where you can say to people, yeah, put the head guard on, what's the worst that could go wrong? You know, so it doesn't work, that's okay. If nothing else, it'll do nothing. But actually that's not true, because if nothing else, it might increase the risk. Because players think they're protected, they take more risks. That's that Superman effect, that risk compensation thing. And even if you do that and you sell something or you endorse something that works and it doesn't work, well, then you've misled people into thinking they're safer than they are. So you can't just do it, you know. It's frustrating, because I think from the outside people say, why are you sitting on this? If there's a potential, go. Yeah, but hang on a moment, you're like, there's a potential for something else to happen too, and we have to be careful. So yeah, that's where we are.
Anyway, so to wrap things up in 2023, and a big thank you to all of you that have been participating in our social media channels, and particularly to our Patreon supporters. If you do want to support us on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com. it's patreon.com, and look for the Science of Sport podcast. And for a very small amount of money, which is about the price of a coffee, or maybe two coffees, depending on what level you want.
Half a coffee in New York.
Yeah, there we go. You can become part of our patrons and be out there and support. And you do get some pretty cool stuff. Once Ross has recovered, there'll be some regular newsletters going out, as there have been in the past. And of course, we do create content, especially for our patron supporters. But big thank you to them, and particularly for their contribution contributions to some of the discussions we've had over the last year. And there's a few standout Patreon members who have been sending us a lot of information that they've spotted. And many of those have led to some of the discussions here on our podcast. So thank you to them and their very big participation. They're almost the third arm of our podcast in many respects, aren't they?
Very much. Yeah. I think people who go on those forums get more value from the post-podcast discussions than they do from the podcast sometimes, thanks to some of you members. And we're going to actually look next year to formalize that. And I know the patron message board thing where I put up a post and then people comment is quite hard to navigate. Sometimes I go there because I'm looking for something that maybe Kevin McQuaid has said. And I say, geez, where was that thing? I can't remember. But we're looking at moving that to a more user-friendly interface and taking some of those comments into the show more regularly. So that'll be something for 2024. Yeah, so massive thanks from me. And again, I'm sorry I've been dormant for 2 weeks, but I'll get on it now.
And you'll see next year we're going to have a new look and some new intro stuff to us. We're upgrading a little bit on our podcast and look forward to hearing what you think about that. But let's just wrap up this year. And my first question to Ross, and it's always an interesting one, is I imagine I know what you're going to say here, but maybe not because I never know what you're going to say. Your sporting highlight for 2023, what would it be?
The quarterfinal of the Rugby World Cup.
I knew you'd say something odd.
So be the but you knew it'd be the Rugby World Cup.
I'm sure. It'd be the Rugby World Cup. Yeah.
No, the quarterfinal against
the South
Africa France game.
Yeah.
But you know, the night before was Ireland New Zealand, and New Zealand beat Ireland in what then looked like one of the great games of all time. And then the next night, that French stadium mentioned it at the time. I've never in my life experienced an atmosphere like the first 20 minutes of that. It was unreal. Mm-hmm. And like the biggest regret of the year is that wasn't the final. That should have been the final. That's the two best teams in the world. Ireland 3, New Zealand maybe 4. But the way that the draw worked out, unfortunately, that game had to happen too early in the tournament. And it took the air out of the tournament a little bit once France were eliminated.
Lost the French support.
Because that match in the final would have been like Armageddon.
Le Bleu would have been going mad.
Unbelievable. But that was, for me, the most incredible sports thing I've ever experienced live. Mm. Unbelievable.
And I mean, you're there at the final watching the Springboks win that World Cup. I mean, that was, and again, being a South African there, that's obviously quite special to be part of that.
Yeah, I remember saying to Leanne, like, this may never happen again. Eh? Like,
yeah,
not just to win a World Cup, but to defend a World Cup.
Yeah.
Like, in our lifetimes, we may not see this, especially the way we did it. Mm. Won 3 points in 3 matches, cumulatively. Yeah. And it's astonishing. Astonishing. Like, it's amazing. Amazing.
For those of you that don't get why it's important here in South Africa for many different reasons. Just a few days ago, we actually had a public holiday, which was there to celebrate the victory of the Springboks of the World Cup. So that's the importance of which, even at national government level, they're seeing it as an important milestone in our South African history, not just around sport. So it's significant.
He missed a trick there because, you know, I think we won that final 12-11, right?
Mm-hmm.
The public holiday should run on the 11th of December so that it would memorialize the scoreline in the date.
I think you're overestimating the ability of our government officials to think beyond their noses. But anyway, credit for them giving it. Well, I suppose there is some debate about whether we should have a public holiday for a sporting event, but that's not a story for that. For
the last World Cup was won 32-12 against England, so that one wouldn't have quite worked, but it should have been a public holiday on the 32nd of December, not quite. Mm. But this one was a chance. You could have made it 12-11. Mm. And for the next however many years, we could have thought back to that day on the 11th.
Yeah, yeah. Sporting events you would have most liked to have seen live?
I was jealous that you were in Budapest without me. Because that looked like a cool. And I think
it was blooming hot.
Yeah. Then I think, where's the next World Champs? Okay, Tokyo.
Been there.
And Tokyo is cool, don't get me wrong, but it's just the jet lag, the travel demand, and so on. And there's something about Europe, you know. So I would have loved to.
I would have loved to
do that. What else has been really good this year? The cycling World Champs in Glasgow. That street circuit looked super cool. That really steep hill that eventually decided the race. Looked like an amazing place to watch cycling from.
I wish I could remember the name of the road because there was so much talk about the road. Same. It was like Bower Street or something. I don't know.
Like that. And then just to be in Glasgow because like It got a lot of criticism, but that Super Worlds would have been fun.
Yeah, mountain biking, road, track, everything together.
To go to that mountain biking circuit where they had that amazing, remember there's some incredible photographs of them doing that jump over the ferns. It looked cool.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is actually, and I'm busy watching it right now again, and I definitely have to go to this, is that cyclocross circuit in Belgium, now at this time of year, where they do like a race on a Wednesday, race on a Saturday, Sunday, and you get to go see Van der Poel, Van Aert, Pidcock, and you get to stand there, watch, drink beers, and watch them race. That looks like one of the coolest sports things to go to.
It's a cool
so like
thing
that's
to
definitely
do.
On my bucket list. Yeah, go to like here in Tulsa, and where was it? This past weekend there were a few. Anyway, that looks cool.
Just the atmosphere at places like that is quite extraordinary. Yeah, yeah. I would say that I wish I'd been at the final of Alcaraz versus Djokovic at Wimbledon. Alcaraz winning that one, but I mean, Carlos Alcaraz is just. I mean, he's definitely the next level up. And we know that Djokovic has ended the year as the world number one and deservedly so. But Alcaraz is just something about that player that he's another level compared to everybody else. The athleticism. The ability to get around the court is just, I mean, he is the best I've ever seen for getting around a court. Whether that will give him some longevity, I don't know, because that could be the question's issues. But he is spectacular to watch as a tennis player, you know. And,
in fact,
I enjoy it.
They played the final in the US as well. Was it the semi final? I lost track a little
pushing
bit.
Pushing me now, yeah.
A little bit. Travel in the World Cup, World Cup rugby. But both those games looked extraordinary. What's interesting there is that Alcaraz was. It feels like he was closer to Djokovic at the end of 22 than he is now.
Yeah, because there's been like more consistency from Djokovic throughout the year. But that's just an age thing. I mean, Alcaraz is 21 years old. You know?
Could be. But it'd be interesting to see whether he kicks on, because he wouldn't be the first player who reaches a level where you predict him to be the next big thing and then you just never quite get on. And he's at like a ceiling of now 99% of Djokovic.
Yeah.
Can he get to 100? Because, whereas last year it looked like he was 99.9.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when is Djokovic going to slide? Every time we think he's on the tail end of his career, he has a year like he's had this year. So it's been amazing.
Yeah.
But it's exciting to watch tennis. And I struggle a little bit understanding the women's game because there's a whole bunch of players which I don't really know who's top and who's, you know, top five. That changes so much. But in the men's game, I kind of get that. And
The women's game remains an enigma because they just. Like, there are so many Grand Slam champions that never make it back to a quarterfinal, never mind another Grand Slam.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, like, how fluid that is compared to how almost anchored men's tennis has been for the last decade. It's interesting.
And the one thing I'd love to do one day, and I don't know whether I'll ever get the opportunity to do this, but just from an experiential perspective, I'd love to go and watch the NFL Super Bowl. Just because I think it's one of those things as a sporting person that you should watch because of the spectacle of it and understand that it's much more than that, but also understand how American sport works to some extent. Because for us living here in South Africa, and I think it probably applies to Europe and Australia and many of our listeners, in fact, our listener base very much in those areas. But sport in America is very different in many ways to sport that we see in the rest of the world. And you can criticize it, but you can also look at it and say the marketing and the ability to create hype is what drives the commercial success of those businesses over there. Whereas maybe we can learn a thing or two from that, but also keep the essence of the sport where it should be. And I think there's always that battle. How glamorous do you make it? How sensational do you make it? How much is your halftime show as important as the game that the people are playing? You know, all that sort of thing. And I look at here in South Africa, we've got this 20-over series that's happening here very shortly. And there's all these different franchises, which I can't keep up with whose franchise is what. And it's a case where I go like, okay, there's a lot of hype, but is there a lot of support other than for the actual cricket, or is it just about the hype of being at the game and the fireworks, etc.? So it's always a debate for me. We talked a bit about Max Verstappen talking about the Las Vegas Formula One track. You know, how much was that hype versus reality and passion? So that's always a debate. And I think to be able to experience an American sporting event like the Super Bowl would just give you some perspective on where American sport is versus the rest of the world.
Yeah, when I was in New York now, we went to watch the Knicks play the one night against the Pistons at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, it must have been amazing.
And then two days later with the NFL, we went to watch the Jets against, was it the Atlanta Falcons? I think it was the Falcons. And the basketball was really good. You know, like those basketball arenas, even Madison Square, which is quite a big one, they're really intimate, right? Because you're enclosed and you're quite close to the court, even when you're in the cheap seats. And then the halftime, and even between, like when a timeout is called, it's amazing. Like they'll call a timeout, and within 2 seconds, there's a group of entertainers on the stage, on the floor. And all the t-shirt cannons come rushing out from every corner, and they fire t-shirts into the cannon, and the timeout ends and they're gone within 2 seconds. It's amazing. It's so well coordinated and scripted. The production of the entertainment is almost as impressive as the play. The football was dead boring. It was rainy and windy and cold, and the teams are fairly mediocre, and I've been to far more entertaining rugby matches than that.
Yeah.
So the spectacle obviously relies on the substance of what's happening on the floor or on the field, but they do get it right. Mm. And it's not for lack of awareness and attempts and trying that rugby's not managed to do that.
Mm.
They just doesn't seem to translate that well. I don't know what it is about it. I'll say in rugby, last weekend, they played a game up in Johannesburg where they had about 2,500 people in an 80,000-seater stadium.
Mm.
Embarrassing.
Yeah.
You got to just put them in a 20,000-seater stadium and get get 4,000 people in a 12 is better than 8 in an 80, in terms of optics and sound and atmosphere. So that's little solutions like that. But yeah, I agree. It's Super Bowl would be very cool to go to because there'd be no lack of hype there.
Yeah.
I was in Phoenix, which hosted the Super Bowl many years ago, and landing at the airport, everything in the airport was about the Super Bowl. And there were people waiting to ask you if you needed any help, NFL staff. There was a Super Bowl expo to which you could buy tickets the 2-3 days before the actual game. And that was getting 300,000 people through its doors.
Mm.
And that wasn't even the game. That was just a fairground, basically. Yeah. Buy candy floss and aim footballs at a hoop, you know.
That's incredible, yeah. Anyway, so plenty to look forward to in 2024. We'll get into what our sort of highlights of 2024 is in our new podcast for that time. But we'll be back in the middle of January, I think we're planning to be. We're taking a bit of a break over the festive season.
Yeah, we look forward to that. I mean, there's a few things to look forward to. You see, Pogacar's entered every race in Italy, basically.
Right.
Did you see that? He's doing the Giro.
Right.
Then Strade Bianche, Milan San Remo, Lombardia. Basically, every race in Italy is going to win next year.
Okay.
So that's interesting for what it means for the tour.
Yeah.
But what I was going to ask you, sort of semi-related to that, is your best podcast of the year.
Oh, crikey. That's a tough one. I think...
Only because I just wanted to give it a punt, because I thought it was so good, my answer.
I think that the episode that we did on carbohydrates, I think, was very fascinating, because I think it's changed not only... My life in terms of that, and I certainly gained from that discussion when we did the double century 200-kilometer race a couple of weeks back, where I certainly learned about that, and I think a lot changed in my life around that discussion. And we've since interviewed people, and you'll hear an interview that we did with this professional cyclist in the new year around that, and it's a game changer, because there's so much of the hype around anti-carbs that when you suddenly realize the reality and you actually start employing some of those tactics, it does change the way you see endurance sport, you know, for me personally.
That the timing of that podcast relative to us doing DC and this race two weeks after was really good. I wasn't necessarily thinking our podcast, by the way, the one I was going to mention was
our best. I know what you're going to say here.
Yeah, there was an interview that the Lantern Rouge guys did with Remco Evenepoel, which was, for me, the best interview of an athlete I've heard.
Yes, I agree.
Like, podcast or not. I thought it was the best interview I've heard, because something about those two guys, like, I think the Aussie humor and the Belgian guys, also quite a funny, insightful. But they also have a lot of knowledge. They clearly have earned the respect of the riders, but they also disarm them. And they got Remco Evenepoel to say things that I didn't think any cyclist would ever say publicly. Yeah. It was amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
And it made me think that that's the kind of interview I'd like to do more of, but then we can dive a little bit more deeply into some of the scientific stuff and explore that. Yeah. So if I had a New Year's resolution, it would be to try and get more elite athlete insights into our podcast. But 100%. That podcast was done, I don't know, you can find it on YouTube. They put it up there, and then you can actually watch it in addition to listen to it. That for me is one of the best athlete dialogues I've ever heard.
Yeah. No, I loved it too. It was really good. Yeah. I would definitely say that was my favorite as much as yours. I can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
I tend to listen to non-sporting podcasts a lot of the time. because yeah. I love the personality profiles that you get on the various channels. But anyway.
Cool.
Anyway, so that's us for 2023. We're going to take a bit of a break, as I said, just for a couple of weeks. We'll be back in the middle of January with a new look, a new feel, a new voiceover, all sorts of new things to look forward to. But for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.